Greetings, Grapple fans, and welcome to the long-awaited, at least I hope that's what you're thinking, episode of Let Me Tell You Something's Meltzer 5-Star Project, the episode in which myself, you Let Me Tell You Something co-host Lorcan Mullen, and your other Let Me Tell You Something co-host
Simon Cross,
discuss four or five matches. One day we'll get it to four. The Dave Meltzer of the Wrestling Observer's rated 5 stars or higher. Because of March Mania, these have been on the back burner for quite a while, but we're finally getting up to date at the time of recording with all the matches that Dave Meltzer's given these ratings of varying numbers, but starting at a base level of 5, which used to be the peak level.
One day in the future, there will be no bitterness and resentment from you in relation to that. I don't know when that will be. I don't know when the next drought's going to be for 5 stars, but one day.
I think at this point, when that ends, the podcast ends.
We'll see.
The podcast was in a perilous position before we decided this. I'm not lying.
I know I've said it several times in episodes, but I did have to talk Lorcan off of a metaphorical cliff with this one.
Yeah. But as far as moves and wrestlers that might be willing to jump off cliffs if it gets them 5 snowflakes from Dave Meltzer, Simon, what in chronological order are the matches we're covering? They may not be in the order that we discuss them, though.
Our first one is a TNA match. 18th of January 2024. It's Will Ospreay versus Josh Alexander on a... It's just on an Impact episode, I believe. It's not a special occasion. Then we go to February 11th, New Beginning in Osaka. We have Bryan Danielson versus Zack Sabre Jr. Two in this current sequence. Obviously, they have faced off before in the indies, but we're not counting that.
Would you call it Zvayan Danielson? Versus Zack Sabre Tunia, Simon?
I would support your decision to call it that, yes.
Ever the diplomat.
We move on a week later to February 18th, 2024, to High Stakes, Rev Pro, in a Crystal Palace Sports Centre or something like that, event centre. It's Michael Oku versus Will Ospreay, part 2. Michael O2 versus Will Ospreay.
You stole my gag, you son of a bitch! You stole my gag!
Thankfully, the original alfalfa belonged to the studio, so no charges got pressed.
Son, William Faulkner could write a sequel pun that would really make you think.
Yeah. But he couldn't write the next match because he's not a professional wrestling producer. It is Will Ospreay versus Konosuke Takeshita, March 3rd, 2024, AEW Revolution, I want to say. Yeah, Revolution. They're adding so many new ones now. You used to know where you stood with an AEW pay-per-view.
Is a worrying sign for this series.
Especially when you go to a AEW Dynamite on March 6th and get a Will Ospreay versus Kyle Fletcher match, which is part of this series as well. If they're on free television as well, then where are my shoes? Oh, they're in the den, dear. In the den? May God have mercy on us all.
If you follow us on Twitter, you'll see the revelry I take in updating Simon on a weekly basis as to whether or not Dave Meltzer's given out any 5 stars or otherwise in the latest Observer.
It's just that last one. Cut the shit. Cut it out.
Obviously, that was the chronological order, but there's a very obvious block of 4 that are unique to the others. So what we've decided to do is start off by talking about the Bryan Danielson Zack Sabre Jr. rematch in New Japan, and then go on to the magical Meltzer East tour that is the end of Ospreay's runaround farewell to all the places that he's known and all the faces that he's seen and whatever that song is at the end of The Office, and then start his new life in AEW. By fighting his stablemates. But we'll get into that. You gotta knock out the biggest kid in the playground. And everyone will know you're tough.
So.
So, what's so funny as well is a couple of name drops that we get in these episodes that they said Will Ospreay says about the match, the final match of the series, the Kyle Fletcher one, we're a long way from Wolverhampton. And then also the Zack Sabre Jr. Bryan Danielson match, and they both keep referring to this match. The Chris Charlton commentary said, like, my girlfriend's mum's best friend or something owned.
Yeah.
In Coventry, I'm pretty sure, because I saw a picture of it. Sometimes I do a thing where, like, a little bit of exercise I give myself is to walk further on two train stations from where I usually get the train after work, because I work in Coventry and live in Birmingham. They're neighbouring cities to each other. There's, like, 20 miles between them, so I take the train in the morning and in the evening. But, like I said, I walk.
I was going to say, that's a hell of an exercise plan. Right, 5 o'clock, time to get the hiking boots on.
And so I walked to a place called Tile Hill, wearing a bulletproof shield at all times, if you know Tile Hill. Stay on the main roads and under the streetlights. That's the key. That's my tip if you're ever walking around Tile Hill.
You're not helping this thing some right-wing Americans push across about us having no-go areas in the UK.
Well, it's not no-go areas in that sense. It's no-go areas in the sense of taste. Than anything.
Snap.
Have you ever been to Tile Hill? I mean, to you, is that like your equivalent?
Oh, careful. Careful now. I've been through Tile Hill. I don't think I've ever stopped in Tile Hill.
Roll them up. Anyway. Yeah, but on that walk, I walked past the bar that I think they've shown as an exterior shot that they had that match. And that is crazy to think. I mean, I could have gone to that match, really, if I'd had the effort. John Lister attended that match.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. So, that's fascinating to look at. And that is actually one, they say it's a 2 out of 3 falls. You know, that was only the case because Zack Sabre Jr. screwed up and was pinned in a cradle that he should have kicked out of in time, and he didn't.
Oh, dear.
And so Danielson improvised by saying, let's turn this into a 2 out of 3 falls match. Conceded a fall almost immediately to Zack and then went back. And so, but now here we are as the rematch to what was a dream match, essentially, the previous year at Dream Slam. Was that what it was called? Wrestle Dream. Because Dream Slam was like that Joshi card from the 90s. So I was excited going into this match because I loved that previous encounter in AEW. It was one of my favourite matches of last year. And I wondered, will this be similarly one of my favourite matches of this year? And obviously right now, I mean, I'll say out of the 5 matches that we will cover in this episode, is probably in the top 2 or 3. But I don't think, didn't quite match up to what we had with the previous one, because it was just, for the most part, a repetition of what we got from Wrestle Dream with a few nuances. But actually, weirdly, the New Japan filming and the New Japan crowd didn't quite work for this match, which surprised me because I thought it would be like a technical display in front of a respectful audience.
Mm.
But instead, there was a couple of people really, really trying desperately to sound like an American crowd throughout it all. Or a British
crowd.
Yeah,
that was weird, wasn't it?
Yeah, I guess because they kind of, you know, there's always that thing of fetishizing something that's different to yours. So often you'll try to sound like a Japanese crowd or something when you're doing, or you show your love for Japanese wrestling, like the introduction of streamers in Ring of Honor and everything.
Oh.
And I guess for Japanese fans, the American stuff and the British stuff is, especially to the obsessives, is as exotic and foreign and something they, I don't know if envy is the right word, but would like to replicate. And boy, was there one or two blokes in that crowd that really wanted to replicate it.
I wonder if they were Japanese or if they were Westerners who were...
No, that sounded like a Japanese voice trying to get that over to me. And it's like, it's not like it's nothing, anything new to hear one voice out of the quiet in a Japanese match, especially in the early stages of. But this one, it was really, again, a continuation of the psychology behind the previous match of both men trying to out-technique the other one, and it eventually descending into a more looser, more strike-based sequence as it went along, and then them just both looking for wins. Like, that sense that they're at a stalemate in the submission department. I thought one of the best moments in the match was Danielson going to the ropes at one point and kind of cursing himself for having to resort to that.
Yeah.
And earlier in the match, he taunted Zack Sabre Jr. with saying, go for the ropes, whilst he held him in the setup for the surf.
And great commentary going, oh, he wants him to do that, so he exposes his arm, and that's why Zack's not doing that.
Mm. And Zack does eventually just have to take the knee attack. Maybe that was the problem I had going watching the match as it went on, because they developed a face-heel dynamic with Zack and Danielson, with Zack being the hometown favourite of sorts. But just the nature of Zack Sabre Jr.'s personality makes it very hard to sympathise with the man.
Yeah. He's a dickhead, but he's our dickhead thing they were trying to go for.
I guess so, yeah. Yes.
This match also has the added element of the spectre of Okada over it.
Mm.
Danielson mentions in the pre-match promo package, you've tried to tap out Okada several times, not managed it. I'm one-on-one for doing it, so, you know, I'm mint me. But also, the arm got broken in that match, so there is a clear weak point. He doesn't come in with the eye patch this one, but he's obviously recently been wearing the eye patch as well. So they don't highlight it clearly, but that's sort of like Zach's in to this match, because he is coming in 0-1, but as he insists, he got knocked out, he didn't tap out, so it doesn't really count in his eyes.
Yeah, well, and that's what plays into the finish and what will eventually lead to the proposed third match on a yet-to-be-determined neutral ground. That would suggest it could be a CMLL, Anniversario, or one of their shows. Neutral ground would therefore eliminate the UK, you would think, unless Danielson was trying to be all like, but actually, the UK's my home crowd more than it is your home crowd, or something along those lines. You assume that the Wembley match is not going to be... it's going to be against a Brit, but it's probably not going to be against Zack Sabre Jr. But I wanted to go back to your point about Danielson, because it feels like... I listened to the English language commentary for as long as I could take it, and then I switched to Japanese.
Really?
Yeah. I think this is a match that a full concentration of what's happening in the ring and not having the... I don't hate Chris Charlton as a commentator. I do think he's a try-hard in the mould of Joey Styles, Mara Ranallo, and... nearly as intended as an insult to him, Matt Stryker. But I can't help it if someone's insulted by that. But the other guy that they've got now is just far too generic commentator for me. And it's crazy to think that the lad's only like 22 or something.
Is he? He sounds much older.
There's plenty of banter going on in the ring for us to not need commentary anyway. As we said earlier on with Danielson taunting Zack in the ropes, and Zack frequently replying, do you want to go there? And training kicks. But I don't know why it felt... and I've so often said, oh, New Japan just know how to film wrestling better than anyone else. For some reason, it felt like it was a remove this time. That the way it was filmed at AEW didn't feel that way. I don't know why it was, but this was one of the first times where I was like, I preferred AEW's presentation of these two guys than New Japan's. I don't know if it's because that arena itself didn't look that... I don't know. I don't know what it was.
I'll take your point on the arena. Yeah, it didn't seem quite as grandiose as the AEW one. And look, the AEW had the advantage of being the first time in this series. And obviously there's that famous saying, sequels are often never as good. In this, I'd put it in the same bracket as the first one. But if I'm ranking the two... And look, I don't know if presentation has subliminally made my perception the way it is, but I think the first one edges it.
The novelty of the exchanges, it's not that they don't feel as crisp, but they don't feel as new. And those things you were loving in the first one, that they were just finding those moments and taking them, there were still fantastic moments in them, but as you say, the novelty wasn't there anymore. This wasn't the dream match, this is just, we know where we are. And they don't change it up enough like they did with, say, the second Okada Omega match, which then became more of a battle of perseverance and Kenny Omega fighting from underneath in the latter half of the match and Okada not being able to put him away. And also that's the problem with the politics, and I guess you kind of had that with the Danielson-Okada match at Tokyo Dome, that there was that sense of, well, this is the returning of the favour.
We know where this is going, yeah.
And so the peril of Zack Sabre Jr. never felt perilous enough, especially since it was meant to be Zack that we had some level of sympathy for with the leg injury as it goes on. Because even though you refer to the eye and the arm Those are not a factor in this match at all. And again, I guess because the arm came from a genuine place, that's why that arm work as well in the first match works more than it does with the leg stuff in this match, because that has to kind of artificially come from a bump that doesn't even look like it should have hurt Zack Sabre Jr. that much. It's that his leg gets caught in the rope on the snapback, but it's not even like off of a suplex or any. And Zack needs to sell it for quite a long time for people to buy it almost. Whereas with Danielson, there's that prior knowledge and he's got it going into the match, and Zack Sabre Jr. baits him into using his arm, and again it's that whole thing of them being in each other's head and it forcing the other one to make an unnecessary mistake. And Danielson is doing that to Zack at various points in this as well, with engagements and strikes where we know that that's where Danielson excels, and that then leads to the finish that it's like Danielson's the better striker, and this match shows that Zack's better at the, I don't know, the escapology, the cradlings,
the transitions,
the flash pins and everything. But we still don't know who's the better submission grappler out of the two of them. I mean, they can talk about having the third match, and they might have the third match, and maybe because it's on neutral ground, that will allow the politics to be a little bit less severe. But I do wonder, like, as long as, maybe because Danielson's wrestling his last year, and it's a way of AEW copying, like, because AEW's been taking a lot from New Japan, and they need to give some stuff in return. So if one of them is their guy submitting to New Japan's guy, but not on AEW traditional TV or New Japan traditional TV. I don't think there's been any real reference to the Zack Sabre Jr. match, this one, in any of AEW's TV coverage. So as far as a semi-involved AEW fan, if there is such a thing, it's just Danielson won the match that counted.
Yeah, as of yet, in the run-up to the Ospreay match, there's been no reference. It's more like, oh, you wrestled Shibata, I'll wrestle Shibata, and I'll show you how far I've come. As of time of recording, this is the case. But Will could easily sneak in the line of, oh, last time you wrestled a Brit, look what happened.
I don't want to transition to Will Ospreay fully yet, so we'll go more into that later. But one of my favourite lines that Ospreay said in his reply is that, I became the star in Japan that you always dreamed of becoming.
Yeah.
I always love it when they find that line that you know it, that would sting, because there's a truth to it.
Yeah.
Danielson got a cup of coffee, as Randy Savage would say, with the IWGP Junior Tag Team title with Curry Man back in 2003. He never got that. His dream was to be the Wild Pegasus of the 2000s, at a point when that wasn't a bad thing to want to be. So much of what Danielson does, and to an extent what Ospreay does in the first two matches of this series, is bucket list jobs.
Yeah.
In a literal sense.
Yep. Christ, I'm sorry, there's a little bit stuck on the Johnny Cash walking the line nature of what you just did. But you're right, he is now just, Danielson's using his influence and the fact that, look, time isn't on my side. I swear he's made an illusion that this is his last full-time year.
Oh, he said that, yeah. That's like the basis of AEW's storylines with him now.
Now, they say a good marriage is based on compromise. So do you reckon Bree's gone to him like, right, fine. You are going to be at home more, but if you want to get your head kicked in two or three times a year, fine. Get it out your system.
That's his lad's weekend out. Me and my mates, we go to Llandudno. Danielson gets his head kicked in a little arena in Aberdeen, Washington, back home or something.
Or tries to pluck Vikingo out of the air and, like, snap his leg off.
Danielson just making odd appearances in, like, his late 50s or something, like Johnny Saint was doing, is a fascinating world I hope we get to live in. Mm-hmm. But I think he said in the promo that he did it because his daughter, like, wanted him around more and didn't want him to wrestle anymore.
Yeah.
The sacrifices we make. But then when, in 10 years' time, suddenly, like all daughters, she wants nothing to do with her parents, maybe he'll be like, fine, I'm going to go wrestle every day then. So yeah, 52-year-old bitter, these Gen Zers and Gen Alphas, they don't know what they don't know how to...
Oh, imagine if he turns into McGuinness on commentary. That'd be the dream.
It's weird that we haven't talked that much about this match, because I could have talked for ages about the previous match, because it is just more of the same, but slightly less, against a cooler crowd, but not in a bad sense. What makes it a bad sense is the people that are trying to make it like an AEW show, and it's not that.
Yeah.
And so it just makes it seem less important or something. Trying to do the Let's Go Dragon, Let's Go Zack, and they're not doing it.
Mm.
That's not what most Japanese crowds do.
Yeah.
Glad that they haven't fallen into that trap, because it used to drive me crazy how much British crowds just would sound like American crowds.
Yeah.
In wrestling shows, until the sort of football chanting element of it came in. And now American crowds often try to sound like British crowds.
Yeah. Globalization's a hell of a thing. But if other people around you aren't buying it, just shut up. Just shut up. You're not winning this. It's not working. Other people clearly don't want to go along with you. And I hadn't considered the bridging point of this match. Maybe because in my head, being aware of Danielson's short time, I thought, well, they're not going to put a third Zach match into his schedule. But now, obviously, we've spoken about it. I'm like, well, of course they bloody would. He'd love to do it. And he is now arguably the most powerful man in the AEW sphere, because he can just go to Tony, I'm doing this. Make it happen. And Tony will go along with it, obviously, because he seems to be getting a lot of help from him backstage as well.
Mm.
Partly because Tony gives a leash, a longer leash to his stars.
What I will say, though, about Tony Khan is that I think he's the reason that Danielson hasn't done a G1.
Yeah.
Because I think he's just had to say to Danielson, look, you're my financial investment, and I don't want to risk you in the physical state you are going over there and wrestling 6 to 10 high-intensity matches in a promotion that I'm not making any money from.
Mm-hmm.
On shows, you don't need to go out for your G1. We've got a G1 at home.
Oh my god. Oh my god. I hadn't thought of it that way. This is the Asda Create Your Own Pizza.
That was its working title before they came up with Continental Classic, which is somehow worse. Again, like, I could just do what I think we did in the first one and just talk about some of the wonderful spots, like the, you know, the necktie thing where they go the cross arms in behind them.
The British surfboard, they called it, didn't they?
Well, no, but I mean when it's standing.
Yeah.
And Danielson applies that to Zach, and then Zach rolls underneath and kicks him away from the arse and everything. I love that. Danielson did do some really good leg work in it. But again, it never quite got over. I do love the fact that both of them had to go to the ropes once each. And as you were saying with the Okada submission hold, they both applied that hold at various points in the match as well. Though weirdly, Zach had Danielson in a bad position there, and as is Zach's way, he started improvising around things and eventually had him in sort of like a side Boston crab that was clearly nowhere near as good as the initial submission hold he had him in. But again, I guess that like left Danielson's arms open for him to go to the ropes if he had to.
I can't criticise him for it, but it is an odd thing in the wrestling sense, but it's not odd in where it comes from. It's like an MMA rule, whereas if a hold hasn't worked in the first, I can't remember the time period, it's somewhere between 15 and or 25 seconds, you need to change because your opponent knows what the hold is and is already thinking of ways of escaping it. So if you transition, they've then got to think about A, deal with the transition. B, if you succeed in the transition, deal with the new hold. So I think it's that catch wrestling realism, which in the fake real world of professional wrestling can jar a little bit sometimes.
Well, I guess my favourite variation of that in wrestling was the spot that Samoa Joe started doing when he joined TNA, where he put the opponent into a series of different submission holds as they're trying to get to the ropes. I think it starts off as he goes into the Boston Crab, then turns it into a cross face, and then when they're getting close to the ropes, he turns that into a Rings of Saturn double armbar. So yeah, so I get that logic. And also, I'm trying to think of the other example of that, and that would be whenever you're fighting a Gracie, where they just will not submit, so then you either have to break their arm.
Yeah.
Or in the case of Matt Hughes, it was like, well, I'll just get on top of you and start punching you until the ref stops the match.
I will kill you.
You're gonna have to.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough.
So, I still really enjoyed the match, but like, whilst that previous match, I think was I might have been in the 4.75 star range. For this one, I don't think I could go higher than 4.25. That would be probably my range.
Yeah, it's close, but it's just not quite there. I'll probably say 4.5.
I think it's the one that has the least intrigue to it, because again, you know the politics of it, so the inevitability's there. But again, I do like the story they're telling over the trilogy of Danielson can outstrike him, Sabre can out-grapple him, I suppose. Or, like, out-cradle him.
But they both want to out-submit the other.
Yeah, and they still haven't got there yet. So you would assume that the third match might be submissions only.
Mm.
And then it might go into a politics thing again of that, where maybe he's got...
Is there a special name for the submission-only Ironman matches that people do sometimes?
They used to do that. It was called Ultimate Submission.
That's it. Thank you.
But I can only remember the Kurt Angle, Chris Benoit version of that.
Mm.
So maybe there are other ones. But I wouldn't do that one either, because then you have tap outs, but then they probably factor them into the psychology of better to tap out now so they have to release the
heart. Yeah, it would dilute it, wouldn't it?
But like I said, I can see the politics of that being that it becomes a referee stoppage or something. We'll see. And maybe you don't, you know, not everything has to have a payoff, but I think if they end up doing a trilogy, I would expect this to be the lesser of the three.
Yeah.
And it's still an extremely good match.
We're incredibly lucky. We live in a world where so much wrestling is accessible to us, and the quality is really good now. Waiter, my caviar is slightly, you know, cold.
Yeah, my diamond heels are too tight.
Hey.
So, now that was the starter. Now into the main course. A junk food extravaganza, some would say.
I'm thinking of Steve Coogan's line in The Other Guys. Best way to tell this story is in the middle. Then to jump back to the beginning, then briefly flash to the end in several ways.
So just to reiterate, so one thing we didn't say was the actual star rating systems, because there's actually only one 5-star match in this series, Simon, in these 5 episodes. So we had the Zack Sabre Jr. Bryan Danielson match, which Meltzer gave 5.5 stars to. The previous match between those two, him also giving 5.5 stars to. So again, like the conversion rate of that being like 4.25 to us, that's a bit low, I suppose. But, you know, these things fluctuate wilder than the Deutschmark in the 1920s.
Or the Argentinian peso right now.
Yeah, I've just got this vision of Dave Meltzer walking around with a wheelbarrow and stars.
I know exactly the image you were.
What are you watching? A 2003 episode of Velocity.
But Brian Kendrick's really good. I don't doubt that. Sorry, Brian.
So we've had the 5.5 stars. So now we're getting Josh Alexander versus Will Ospreay at Impact, which was given 5.5 stars. Then right. We have Michael Oku against Will Ospreay at High Stakes, Rev Pro, which was given 6 stars. And then the match against Konosuke Takeshita gets 5.75 stars. And the match against Carl Fletcher is where we're at the lowest, we might as well gouge our eyes out, rate of 5 stars.
Yeah.
So yeah, we've got like the first two matches of this are the final steps of Will Ospreay's farewell tour that he's been doing all over the place. We've had some of the New Japan stuff. The 5-on-5 New Japan version of War Games, I think Meltzer gave like 4.75 stars to.
I think that's cost them one of the War Dogs, hasn't it?
Yeah, possibly. I don't know if that was what cost them the War Dog or if it was just part of a long-standing issue.
Mm.
But that's not what we're here to talk about. What we are here to talk about is Will Ospreay, and we'll be us talking about him. You know that end of the Father Ted series? Forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever. He's just turned 30, and this is like matches 34 to 37 that Dave Meltzer's given 5 stars or higher to. We've only just got started.
Look, I'm just using him now as a framing device for other wrestlers. That's the way I view it, and that's the way I cope. And cope sounds like a horrible word, but without being funny, literally the reason we're now doing Blocks of 5 is in part not because of the viewpoint of how Meltzer views Will Ospreay. It is. And the words you can say about him is finite, isn't it?
Yeah. What is it about Will Ospreay that Meltzer connects to? And I think it is just that he does all the emotional epic stuff, I suppose. But his execution and his speed and his accuracy is so special.
Yeah.
And I think when you, especially with the Michael Oku match and the Kyle Fletcher match, when you put him up against people that aren't quite of that level yet, because they're both very young and they might get there, it's noticeable. I think wisely, in both those cases, they kind of incorporate that into the stories of the matches.
Well, if I could branch off of that point, I'm going to talk about Oku first here, because we have a sample size. We have a previous encounter. And Oku, for my money, is a lot better and a lot smoother in this match. There were some slips in the first match. Look, at the end of the day, it's stuff that I could never even dream of accomplishing in my current physical state. So I'm not having a go. I'm just saying he's developed and kicked on. And you can see that. And his character work as well. Like, he connected with me more in this match. Maybe because I watched the pre-match video package and there was more explanation. I had the journey of seeing the first match myself. And the story is, look, I'm not going to take the title away from RevPro because I love RevPro. I just want to take it from you because I don't like you as a human being.
Well, I think that was a very clever way of them working it within the storyline so that it doesn't feel like an inevitability necessarily, like the Zack Sabre Jr. Danielson match maybe felt like.
Yeah.
Because I think also within the storylines outside of Will Ospreay's involvement, Michael Oku is definitely on a journey towards a similar kind of alpha status, and that weird thing that seems to so often happen, especially in, I think in indie promotions where the person that you build as your top star eventually moves on. And so it's often that it has to be that the crowd are on their side when they're making that journey. But then when they become the champion, their attention shifts. That used to happen to so often with Ring of Honor champions and so on. And then it kind of becomes the idea that the championship and that status becomes a corrupting force. And I think that there are little moments in this match that you can look back in hindsight and say that was a teaser to where Michael Oku goes. In particular, I think the moment where Will Ospreay hits Oku's partner, Amira, where I felt like there was enough ambiguity in the way that that happened that Oku, you could say, sacrificed her. Like, the two times that Amira gets hit in this match, it doesn't make Oku's blood boil and he goes apeshit. He hits Ospreay and everything, but there's no, like, sudden he's on top of him and punching and raining down punches on top of him. It's like that sense of, I can't let my emotions get to me like I did in the previous one. Yeah. But it can also read that as, I don't really care that much what happens to her. They can pay off. Or they can both say we're kind of sadists that enjoy sacrificing ourselves for the other one.
I knew one spot of this match before I watched it. There's this moment where Mira gets hit, and then the move that immediately follows is the Sami Zayn through the ropes DDT. Not like a, I'm just going to like ground and pound
you.
But Ospreay gets himself into that position, so I can understand why a high flyer would think that's the best move to do rather than run round, because it is as the crow flies. And afterwards, when he goes to check on Amira, Amira's like, what are you doing? Focus on him. So yeah. It makes enough sense, if that, you know.
But if your eventual goal is to have him be like the arrogant top dog heel of the promotion, like Will Ospreay has been, there are moments in this match that already allude to that for later periods. This is kind of a dodgy thing to admit. When we did a version of this, when one of our co-hosts did a version of this in the Best of Worst of British, we kind of punished him. But when I looked up on Cage Match, because I was watching this quite late at night last night, and I looked at the match length, I was like, fuck this. And it didn't surprise me with 40 when I saw that this whole match is 47-11. So I was like, okay, I know how they're going to do it. This is where Will Ospreay's like, look what I can do. It's not just about the moves. But it really is just the same number of moves. But then an additional 15 minutes of pausing and looking at the crowd and everything. And I get it. That's what wrestling is. But you know, that's you trying to prove that you can do like the stuff that Hulk Hogan can do. But the thing is, Hulk Hogan does that in 20 minutes. When I just out of curiosity, because I was on my phone, I had to watch it on my phone instead of on the telly, which is how I'd usually like to watch wrestling matches. I just did look at the gear settings, and it said 1.25 speed, and I did watch it at 1.25 speed. Aww. Because I can convert it in my head. I knew what they were doing, and I knew how it would look like at one speed, but I just wanted to shave 10 minutes off because I wanted to go to bed.
Just a quick peek behind the curtain. Like, personally, I couldn't understand that, but Lorcan has informed me before that he's, I think, is it 2x speed you're on podcasts with now?
2.2 now.
I mean, that blows my mind, so
you have to work your way up to it.
Yeah.
I do worry if I ever talk to any of these people that I listen to on podcasts. I'm just going to be doing like this as much as possible to drag you up with their observations, because subliminally that's what I think they sound like.
No, I think you're going to be like, you're on Molly or something, just like, yeah. Huh?
Well, that is it. When I do sometimes accidentally put it at 1x speed or whatever, or 1.2, which is how I can listen back to us, I am like, they sound drunk. And the music sounds so boring, because I'm hearing the theme tunes of the podcast at 2.2 speed, and I'm like, this is a waltz. What the hell is this music that you're suddenly listening
to? I guess the advantage of, well, watching Ospreay matches, sometimes you feel like you're watching on 2x speed anyway.
That's why I think Meltzer loves what Ospreay so much, because he's pushing it to a point that no one's ever gone to before physically. That he's doing the high-flying big moves that obviously always intrigued Meltzer, and he loved, because he loved all that Joshi stuff from the 90s, and that was all about as many big moves as you can pack into a match as possible. You usually get kickouts. I mean, in this match, we do get Oku kicking out of, like, his finishing combo, wasn't it? It was, like, the Storm Driver 90 for 3, or whatever it is, the Hidden Blade, and the Stormbreaker, and Oku kicked out of it.
Yeah.
Which is, that's a proper, I'm moving on now, so that's Macho King Randy Savage hitting 5 elbow drops off the top rope.
Yeah, it is, it is.
So, yeah, I just knew that's what they were giving us, so I was like, I can see that in my head, so I'm going to give it 1.25 so I can just go at a pace that I can tolerate, because there are those moments where they're just suddenly going to be on their knees looking at their opponent whilst they do the big, oh my, I've been so whacked out of it and I can barely move. And the problem I have again with these kind of matches is they're doing that from like minute 5.
Yeah.
And they're doing it into minute 47. You know, that criticism that Jim Cornette had about Johnny Gargano, that he always does that glazed over look, and it's like, well, if you truly are like that, then you can't go 20 minutes more in a match. Look, of the epic matches that we're covering for this, this was one of the better executed ones. And the drama and everything, and Amira?
Yep.
Amira at ringside, she plays her part very well as well, with the bloody towel, and at the end her taking that shot, and then when Oku's got him in the finishing half crab, she's flipping off Will Ospreay as he's trying to make that decision. What I will say about Oku as well is wrestling style and his moves are fairly simplistic in comparison to many other people who are trying to stand out in the, well, you know, his finisher is literally a half crab, and his other big moves are like a frog splash.
Yeah.
Which is a little, I love the Tanahashi love that he was showing with his going,
doing it
getting
twice
out of the ring, going up. No, but get how he gets out of the ring the same way that,
yeah,
Tanahashi gets out of the ring. Although the frog splash itself is in the style of D'Lo Brown, which is another one who I've got love for. So that's a double reference I'm really getting behind. And his big move is like the Asai moonsault off the top rope. And he does that a couple of times in this match. And those are impressive. But for the most, he doesn't clearly just go for the flash. He wants there to be substance in his stuff. And he does it well. He's not the complete package yet. And that, I guess that is the issue that you have going into this. That, like, the only reason that Michael Oku's in a 5-star match is because it's Will Ospreay. And I don't yet see the Michael Oku that can take someone else into a 5-star match.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe in a year or two's time we will. But I do wonder, like, now that Will Ospreay, and especially now with Okada having moved on to basically being AEW exclusives, is this the end of RevPro, New Japan, and this brief dalliance of TNA Impact being in this Meltzer 5-star project going forward? I genuinely, looking at the New Japan roster now, wonder if we're going to get another 5-star match the rest of this year.
If we look at how he introduces people to this list, once there's one, there's loads.
Mm.
And like the water has been broken now with Oku. It's been broken with Josh Alexander. It's been broken with Speedball Mike Bailey.
But those are all with Will Ospreay.
That's the thing, isn't it? Is it just him,
yeah,
which is what the point you're making, or could you look at it as now that the dam's been burst, there could be like little offshoots from this?
Potentially, but is there any one of those levels of skill? Like, we kind of argue that the dam's starting to be broke now because of Kento Miyahara and Katsuhiko Nakajima.
Yeah.
So then he gives another Katsuhiko Nakajima match against Aoki, 5 stars or 5.25 or whatever he gave it, and then another Miyahara Nakajima. So, like, just as a promotion now, All Japan has two of them that Meltzer can see that in.
Yeah.
I don't know that Josh Alexander versus Mike Bailey is going to get 5 stars. If I found out that was what was being booked for the next TNA event, not just because I think those two are very demotivated wrestlers right now by the sounds of it.
Mm.
Just in general, I don't think Meltzer's suddenly like, I can't wait to see the match between those two. I think it was more, I can't wait to see what Will Ospreay can do with Mike Bailey and Josh Alexander, and it led to it meeting my expectations. I do think out of the four of them that we saw, I think the best match for Ospreay actually was Josh Alexander, even more so than Takeshita. And I do like Takeshita, but I think the match that impressed me the most out of those four was the Josh Alexander one. And I also had watched the previous match that Meltzer had given 4.75 stars when it was Impact Wrestling. They had their Impact match and then they had their TNA match. And I think it's because that was a story that it meant as much to Josh Alexander as it did to Will Ospreay. And it didn't have the over-the-top drama, I felt, that the Michael Oku had. Although it does have it with that table spot very early on in the match. I felt more of a sense of definitive triumph and it being a battle of equals between Josh Alexander and Will Ospreay. I felt like Josh Alexander has a skill and a connection level that is above Michael Oku. I came out of this wanting to watch more Josh Alexander. I didn't come out of the Oku match as desperate to watch Michael Oku. I'm not against it. If Michael Oku's show going to be at a show that I somehow attend live because someone's got the Hades Cerberus the dog to drag me out of my room to go to a public event with wrestling fans, I would be excited to see it.
I'm in a similar boat to you, but I've come about it from a different approach. I do want to see more Josh Alexander, but it's because I didn't rate that match that well compared to some of the others in this series. I think of the Ospreay 4, it's third for me.
Okay.
I think it's more because I enjoyed the other two more. I did like the Oku match because one of the things I try and judge against to give my veneer of impartiality to whatever I, as part of this, like, was to attach, if I was to attach a rating to it, is does the match accomplish what it sets out to do? And Oku definitely does that. Takeshita definitely does that. Fletcher does, but on a different level. And look, this is my fault. This is my first Josh Alexander match. I haven't really known a lot about Josh Alexander except the fact that his contract extension has sort of pagged his career desires.
Well, we don't know that one way or the other, I think. It's more just the fact that it was enforced upon him.
He asked if that year couldn't be added on, but they said no. So he did ask them. But the way he's positioning in it, I don't know if it's because he's positioning it in the public domain, is it was a no-risk-it-no-biscuit thing, not I desperately don't want to be here.
Yeah, I don't know where Josh Alexander would be better suited, though. I think he would be lost in the shuffle in AEW like his old partner Ethan Page has.
Which is a crime! It's a crime!
But then if, like Ethan Page, you'd just been stuck in Ring of Honor, well, that's that's an even more land of make-believe than TNA is at this point now. Mm. Insofar as like, oh, that's still a thing. Yeah, I should, but I'm not gonna. I can't see him going to WWE. He's 36 years old, and he's not really what they'll have a focus on. And those days of what NXT used to be aren't there anymore. If it was black and gold NXT, yeah, that'd probably be the best place for him to go to.
He could do a Shawn Spears style thing of being like the veteran hand for them to work with and work off of.
Yeah, but why would you do that when you can be the biggest star in another promotion?
Money.
Yeah, maybe, but I don't know that people who go to NXT, I somehow don't think that Shawn Spears is getting paid that much in WWE.
Mm.
He's not going to be their top priority merch provider, whereas I'm guessing in TNA.
Yeah.
New Japan could be an opening because there's that gap in the
Gaijin market.
Then I would be what, you want to stay with TNA as your home base promotion, but maybe ask that your bookings with New Japan take priority and you'd be more like a visiting special attraction in TNA. But he doesn't know that that's what New Japan wants. Who the fuck knows what New Japan want now?
They don't know.
You really think we want this much evil? You really think we want this much House of Torture?
Apparently, the Japanese fans love House of Torture.
Who the fuck knows with that place?
But the Western translation's just not there. But you look after your home market first, don't you?
I get that. Well, that's why I don't think that Josh Alexander going to New Japan, I don't think he's suddenly going to be their Kenny Omega, which is probably what he wants to be. And the story of this match was kind of, TNA is my house, you're an interloper.
Yeah.
With it down to them being who's going to be the one that gets to hit the Styles Clash. Because that is essentially who is the AJ Styles of this time.
Mm.
And Will Ospreay can claim that that AJ Styles is his main inspiration, and that's why he wants to come to TNA to fulfill some sort of, again, bucket list, wish list kind of thing.
Yeah, but he also tries it on Oku, doesn't he? He also tries it on Takeshita.
Yeah, well, that's just Will Ospreay's, I've got a new toy and I want to show it to everyone.
Look, it's a lot better than John Moxley's cutter. Whatever that is needs to stop.
Cutters in general are in great overuse. Someone hits a cutter in the Ospreay Oku match, and that was one of the few spots that really didn't work because they didn't land it properly. Cutters are an overused move, but not quite as overused as Reverse Rana! of which there are four in this series.
The Simpsons picture of Say the Line Bart got dropped to me a lot when Lorcan was watching these matches.
Well, at least he had the discipline to not use it in one of those matches. I can't remember which one it was now. I think it might have been the Oku match. Mm. No, it wasn't the Oku match. Maybe it was the Takeshita match. They did every other move. But basically, he did two reverse Ranas in one of these. I think it was in the Fletcher match, possibly.
There's two in the Fletcher match.
There's a lot of reverse Ranas. I'm not going to go on about it. At least one of them was the reverse Rana that I like, which is off the second rope, which gives the opponent time to do a full rotation.
Not die.
And not die.
Yeah.
That was where I was at with those. Mm. But again, that's one of those things where it's like, yeah, Meltzer can love Will Ospreay all he likes. He's never going to be as much my cup of tea. But you look at it, and it's like he's trying to show off his versatility. And the fact that he is, when people are saying he's the best wrestler in the world right now, at least as far as what someone can do in the ring, I can't dispute that.
Yeah.
He's doing stuff in the ring that no one else can match in accurate, as I said, in speed, in accuracy, in explosiveness. But even he can run the risk and end up burning his back and nearly landing on his head because of Kinosuke Takeshita's brainbuster attempts.
That was brutal. But how they worked that into the Fletcher match, I liked. Because
Yeah.
Those are the two that have the storyline link, and those are 4 days apart? That's good. And we do have Ospreay obviously trying to prove himself and like finish his obligations, and in the process make the other guys look really, really strong, which for Oku he does. Let's see what Oku does with that going forward. The tools are there in the toolbox, and yeah. I don't worry about Josh Alexander at Impact because it's Josh Alexander at Impact. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's fine. That's set.
Or TNA now, Simon. You've got to get used to saying that now.
Sorry, again. Yeah.
I like both of the stage setups for TNA and RevPro. And I didn't think the commentators were as bad as they are before, because one of the commentators was Gideon Graves, who was the money behind the United Empire in the storyline.
I can't remember if this was before Anthem tried to push him out or not, but the Scott D'Amore promo afterwards of like, I love this place! I'm like, that is a man that cares. That is a man who cares.
It is such a staggering place that we've come from. When we were talking about the year in review, we're like, are we going to have to start paying attention to TNA? Because this is quite exciting. It took them 2 weeks. No, we don't. We don't, because they're TNA. They're going to do what they always do.
They are Spursy. TNA are Spursy, aren't they?
Yes. They are very Spursy. We should get Ibs to watch it.
That's just mean.
But accurate.
And funny.
With the TNA ones, whilst those two were Ospreay returning the favour and taking those losses, essentially establishing Alexander as the ace of TNA and Oku going forward as the ace of Rev Pro. Now Ospreay's essentially saying, I'm here to become the ace of AEW and become the biggest star in wrestling.
Yeah.
Because I'm already the best wrestler. And the crowd just love him already. And it's funny as well, people are saying, like, look at the way that AEW have made the three major free agent signings of recent months in Ospreay, Okada, and Mercedes Moné. And look at the differing levels of success they've had so far. Because Mercedes Moné requires a thing that Tony Khan's not very good at. Caring about women. No, it's not that! But the presentation has to go beyond work rate. And it's also,
you can't give her the one over woman there is, because that would cut her off at the heels. So they're going down this weird TBS route.
And because Tony Khan never bothers trying to get more than one woman over at any one point, there is not a large number of women for Mercedes Moné to interact with that gets the crowd excited.
Julia's kind of over, but her momentum's like stalled a bit.
And that's only because, well, I've got a second belt, so I need to have a second belt holder.
Mm.
We'll hold that conversation for another time. Yeah. And one where we get a woman involved and we make sure to record it properly.
Oh my god, another cliff I had to talk him off of.
Anyway, but my point is that Okada's been booked very well because they've got the Young Bucks, so there's always that, like, Young Bucks have always been the priority, even above the tag team titles. When they don't hold the tag team titles, the Young Bucks will have something to do. When another team holds the tag team titles, there's not always something for them to do. Whereas With Will Ospreay, so far, his genius extends to the level of Mr. Burns telling Daryl Strawberry to hit a home run. I'll put you in a match with someone that you can have a really good match with, and you go and have a really good match.
Yeah.
So, but, as has been pointed out, Ospreay is a hell of a promo as well. And he is as over with the crowd with saying bruv all the time as he is with any of the stuff he does in the ring. And maybe he is the closest thing to, like, if you go by Bret Hart's metric of how you rate a wrestler, it's three categories of 10 out of 10. What can they do in the ring out of 10? What is their look out of 10? And what is their promo out of 10?
Yeah.
Ospreay's a minimum of 8 on all counts.
Mm. It is weird yet endearing to see, like, so many Britishisms. We have in our mindset what we think Americans think we are, which is what William Regal was.
The Downton Abbey world. The weird obsession so many Americans have with our royal family.
Yeah.
It's like, if anyone talks to me about the royal family who's an American, I just will want to say, I don't give a fuck, and most of us don't.
Yeah. But AEW's two principal Englishmen now are a very angry Geordie and a cheeky Essex lad, and I am living for it.
Yeah. That he's got bruv so over kind of makes me want them to do at least a little short run with him against Riddle.
Oh.
Just... You know how there's a thing exercise where you can only say, like, one word or one line over and over again, and then it becomes a case of the inflection and the timing and the where you are and the way you say it, you can do a whole scene where you understand what's happened from start to finish. I would quite like to see a bruv off versus a bro off with, like, that basketball scene. Dude. I never thought of it like that. I think they're deliberately going to try and keep Ospreay and Okada apart for as long as possible. I think the logical thing to do, actually, would be to have them both go undefeated. And maybe that should be the all-in match. I don't think you need to race Ospreay into the world title picture.
Mm.
Have them both go undefeated, and then in July, suddenly have Ospreay call out Okada and say, I need to beat you, and I need to beat you at Wembley. Ospreay v Okada in just a, who's going to be the first one to lose in AEW at Wembley Stadium? That, because it's always been Okada's always had hometown advantage, essentially.
Yeah.
Rather than what I think people are expecting, which is Ospreay against Swerve Strickland for the title. I don't think that's...
I don't want Ospreay to piss on Swerve's chips.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think Ospreay does not need the title yet. Or you can have it be that the winner of that gets the title shot to All Out, and then you can go down a very interesting path with that.
Because of Labor Day weekend, they're perpetually going to be a week apart. Wild. But okay, you do you.
Which means we always get the WrestleMania Night 1. We get the tag team title main events.
Look, we've done being a British fan, and we've done how we've been, like, starved previously. But if you give me a WrestleMania Night 1 in the UK, yes, I'll do it. If you give me Clash at the Castle, yes, I'll do it. I thought about doing Money in the Bank, but then they put it in, like, no offence to the O2 Arena, a comparatively tiny arena.
Are you going to All In 2? Have you got your tickets?
Yep, got my ticket.
Yeah.
I've bought a cheaper tier this time, because look, I went, funnily enough, All In because it was a one-off, and now it's not a one-off. It's like, ah, but on the flip side, if you pardon the pun slightly, there's more that could happen here now this time around.
Also, my guess is that you will see within an hour or so those seats, quite a few rows in front, aren't being filled, so maybe I can sneak in there. It's not going to be a matching number, I don't think, even if you do book like Ospreay Okada or Ospreay Strickland or whatever, or Danielson McGuinness. That's the thing that would, like, tempt. I haven't got the tickets yet, and I'm going to a different thing in London the week after that is kind of my big indulgence for the year, so I don't know that I will. And like you say, because I know that more likely than not there's going to be an All In 3, that makes it not be a necessity, and I really do think it's going to bite them in the ass. Look, just do a Dynamite down the road from where I live at the NIA. That's all I'm asking for. That's all I need.
I don't know. I reckon I could get... how many does the NEC hold?
But that's not the point. They could fill the NEC. They could definitely fill the NEC. And that's one of the funny things about the Revolution match. Boy, are there shots that are going, see? There are fans on all sides of the arena. See?
Yeah, Tony wants the smoke at the moment, doesn't he? But that is Tony on Twitter.
I don't know. Is this like a... have they consciously just suddenly got better at filming stuff? There weren't really any...
they've brought in new staff.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was the handover period
has now led into, right, now you're in charge, now the rebrand, now X, now Y, now the tunnels are back. It looks fresher more recently, and it needed it.
Again, it's that idea, it's not just that we must succeed, it's that they must fail. Now, when it comes to Villa and Birmingham City, I'm never going to change that. But AEW and WWE is a stupid thing to have a side for. It is ridiculous to care for, like, not just, it's okay to be a fan of one, but I don't get being an anti-fan of the other. I genuinely don't get that. During the height of my Ring of Honor time, I wasn't going, I want WWE to be miserable and fail. I didn't care enough. That's not worth caring about. Don't get me wrong. Birmingham City needs to be relegated to League One so that we can play them in the Domino's Pizza Cup or whatever it's going to be called.
Papa John's. And you know what you're doing. You know full well what you're doing. So stop it now.
These Meltzer projects are going to go really weird now. Like, if we'd have done separate episodes about each of these ones, we would have gone into more detail. And there will be stuff that I'll be annoyed at not mentioning when I listen back to this.
I do want to say about the Fletcher one. Now, I like Kyle Fletcher. I like Kyle Fletcher a lot. But our example of, is the only reason you're in a five-star match is because it's Will. Yes, with an extra. It's the dilution that gets that to five, because lovely match, don't get me wrong. And Will clearly likes Kyle. That's why he got so much offense, because the Ring of Honor TV champion beating the hottest thing in, like, getting that much against the hottest thing in wrestling is a bit weird. But it's not. It's just not.
I think Will Ospreay always wants every match he has to be as awesome as possible. And that's admirable in many ways. And now that he's working on an AEW schedule where eventually he'll really only be working about 30 to 35 matches his entire... Well, maybe a bit more now because of Revolution. But he can kind of... To be honest, Will Ospreay probably could have 35 five-star matches from Dave Meltzer in the course of a year. Because of how he works them, as long as he can physically go, and, you know, he's a physical marvel, really, that he can still do all this stuff. And what's crazy is that this is him slowed down. This is him taking his time. Not to the excesses of the Michael Oku match, but I'm sure if he does eventually become the ace of the promotion and their standard bearer in the years going forward, we will get those 47-minute matches.
I mean, the definitely inevitable... whenever it happens match between himself and MJF, that's gonna be, you're gonna have your powders, that's gonna be a whole thing.
That was actually one of the things I really wanted to look at in this match, and it was fascinating to watch. This is the first time that I can think of, maybe they did it during their six-man tag against the Elite back in the day on AEW, like, I think that was Will Ospreay's first AEW match. They had to do commercial break wrestling.
Yeah,
and that was them, at least in the first one of those, just going into the corner and doing the 10 punches spot. That's like a Hacksaw Jim Duggan spot that's been driving Jim Ross crazy since 1983.
Kyle's shithouser in this match is good. Like, the whole chop exchange, and then he's like, nah, super kick, because I'm not winning this.
I'll tell you what, though, if I was Triple H and I was told you can pick three people from the AEW roster to sign for WWE, I think Kyle Fletcher would be one of those three. He has NXT guy written all over him. He's huge. He can go. He's got an interesting look, and he's 25. So he's moldable. And that's why it's silly that this has got five stars, because the whole point of this match is essentially a to be continued. It's a very good chance that Kyle Fletcher is the guy that Will Ospreay wants to have the Michael Oku match against in AEW in 4 or 5 years' time.
Yeah. But then obviously you've got Mark Davis coming back, and obviously Kyle Fletcher's tag journey as well.
Yeah, but I think, you know, I hope that it won't be as bitter as the Santana Ortiz split up.
Well, that was very different.
Is there a large age gap between the two of them? It certainly looks like there is.
I think it's a few years.
I'm not saying that he's Jim Neidhart, but he is Jim Neidhart.
Ooh.
And there's going to be a place for Mark Davis elsewhere, and maybe we'll get surprised, and in 5 years' time, and it's not like that hasn't happened, that it's Mark Davis that becomes... We don't know what they're like backstage, who's got the psychological strength, and who will just find that connection. But I would be investing in Kyle Fletcher's stock a lot more than I'd be investing in Mark Davis' stock, and I think that AEW know that, because you could have put Carl Fletcher in much more of a holding pattern than having him win the Ring of Honor TV title and be a key part of this Don Callis family storyline. He's essentially the young boy of this group. I thought it was interesting as well with Don Callis's commentary. I felt like he could have done more with it in the sense that he's showing off and like, look how great my roster is, and they're even having matches against each other because they're not worthy of each other. But then you can play that up as like, he's getting a paid off of both of them. He's getting his share of the winner's and the loser's purse. And there's one moment towards the end of the Takeshita match where I think Takeshita does, maybe it was that brainbuster spot, where it was suddenly like Don Callis' voice was like, wait, I want both of these guys to be alive and earning me money after this. I started to regret this decision. And I felt like they could have played that more up in the next match, because the whole point of Carl Fletcher is he's kind of the whipping boy of the team.
Mm.
And that, you know, Don Callis has been mistreating him and tormenting him, getting his rocks off, getting his jollies, which is what, you know, Jose Mourinho would do that when he'd take over a football club. He'd pick someone in the squad and just destroy them psychologically.
We've all seen the Dele Alli scenes in the Amazon Prime documentary.
Yeah, so that's kind of, and I like, so I kind of would have liked it to almost be like, oh, well, why are you giving him a chance? Why are you even letting him just smoke this kid?
But he plays it off well.
Carl, they play, and again, that's another thing they do during the commercial break. They do just do a little mid-match handshake. It's like a way of just buying some time, not doing anything too big, because not enough people are watching, but it still works within the story of the match. It didn't feel as out of place as a lot of those commercial wrestling spots have done when we've watched those in these Meltzer of Five Star projects. It doesn't feel like a momentum kill.
Yeah.
And again, that's another sign that Ospreay knows that crowd work. Like, Ospreay doing that pointing to the crowd, to which side of the crowd he wants to do the Ospreay chant when he enters, that's Hulk Hogan cupping his ears. I've said, like, how crazy is it that there are almost next to no wrestlers that in the last 30 years have taken Hulk Hogan as their main inspiration? The Ultimate Warrior kind of did with his comeback. The only other guy after that has been the Velveteen Dream, and look where that got us. But you get where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
Like, Will Ospreay wants to show I could do a Hulk Hogan match. And that was kind of what he wanted the Oku match to be, but it was, you know...
Ah.
It was more, you know, it was also part of the Triple H... There was also... Yeah, but there's also the Triple H WrestleMania main event... Don't trust me, it'll work.
Grand entrance with all of his robes. That was I like that.
Yeah, but it would have helped if one of the guys had not lost their hood somehow, and it was just some bald bearded bloke in his 30s. Because that was obviously they're meant to be doing, like, the John Cena.
Well, and the Assassin's Creed, because it's about the Brotherhood, and they all, like, are hooded. So I could do a rant about the Assassin's Creed series and all that stuff, but I'm not going to go into that.
Yeah, and I think Madonna's done that as well with, like, various drag artists playing different versions of her life, and then she comes out with, "This is, what have you stolen from the black and or gay culture of New York this week, Madonna?"
Wow, okay. I mean...
True.
I'm not disputing the accuracy. I just didn't think that's... So... If you told me... Actually, no, I know us by now.
You could have got a month of episodes of us breaking each of these matches down and talking for even longer. Instead, you're getting a bumper-filled version where we're going in and out of the matches. And like I said, there is stuff that I wish I'd made a point of. But I think, like just for rating's sake, I would say I would go 4.25 to 4.5 in the Josh Alexander match. I just felt like Alexander met Ospreay at his pace, gave his own work within it, and his kind of hybrid AJ Styles, Kurt Angle version, and why he did feel like kind of the embodiment of the best stuff of TNA. And I haven't seen enough of his stuff during his title runs, but he has been essentially the ace of TNA, and it was a believable win. And I wasn't that crazy about the table spot that early, but it worked then in him coming back and finishing off Ospreay with his Styles Clash and then his finisher, which I thought was a great way of saying, I'm the TNA guy. I'm the inheritor of what AJ Styles gave, not you. You're the tribute act. I'm the real deal. And it worked. Yeah, and I love that arena setup as well. Like, if TNA need a home base, I think that place looked great. It was Las Vegas, because I thought it might have been the Hammerstein Ballroom. It had that similar kind of...
Was that the Palms in Vegas, wasn't it?
Yeah. It looked good, except for those weird drapes that were advertising some sort of knockoff mummy film that I feel like you get on Tubi or something. I don't know what that was all about. I would have had excitement for TNA until everything happened, and now they're about to lose the Motor City Machine Guns, probably. But as long as Josh Alexander's there, as long as he's motivated, hopefully he'll still be bringing the goods there. And I need to watch more Josh Alexander stuff. I like his look, I like his gimmick, I like his style.
Yeah.
I mean, what he's putting his body through as well, we might not get much more of that.
I feel this episode's been in a weird space, where it's sort of been more like a semi-State of the Union address we've sort of done. Look, we've said it already. There isn't more to say about Will Ospreay, really. That's why we focus more on his opponents this time. At least I have, and I think you have as well.
I think there's more to say about Ospreay, but it's one of those things of where is Ospreay in 6 months' time? Because it seems pretty obvious that Tony Khan thinks, this is probably my guy for the next 5 years. Because he can do the promos, he can do the crowd interaction. The fans love him. And he's still physically able to go. And even if he does end up slowing down a bit, he's not got him at nearly a physically broken down stage as he got Kenny Omega when AEW was starting up in 2019. He's only 30.
And look, he has none of his pillars at the minute, does he?
Yeah, he really shouldn't have called those guys his four pillars.
Yeah.
But I think, again, I think maybe WWE are slightly kicking themselves over not getting Ospreay. That was the one out of the three, even more than Sasha Banks, I think they should have got. But I have faith that AEW will care about Ospreay. I don't have faith that they'll do the right work. They'll know exactly how to market Mercedes Moné or Okada long term. But I don't doubt that Ospreay... Again, if in doubt, tell him to hit a home run and he'll hit a home run.
Yeah, they'll figure it out. I do have faith they'll figure it out.
And I do have faith that Ospreay will be able to do the angles and all that kind of stuff as well. And he's a decent enough actor. Because I don't think he can hide his personality. I feel like that is what Ospreay... I don't even know if it needs to be turned up to 11. I feel like that's...
No, it's just him. Anyway.
Obviously, you can't be as mouthy as he can. You know, you're not going to get that. What's that supposed to mean? I'm dyslexic, you fucking cunt.
Yeah.
Well, you might. But hopefully they'll have the 10-second delay. Stop it. And AEW have the roster that he can have all these matches with. And I mean, I'm fascinated. Okada and Will Ospreay against like Adam Copeland. Just what that will produce is fascinating to think about. And as you say, MJF.
Ospreay Christian. Ospreay Ray Phoenix. Ospreay Vikingo when he's fit. Ospreay Darby Allin. Yeah. Hell, Sammy Guevara versus Ospreay.
Well, we're previewing essentially all of our future episodes.
Let's not give away the farm.
Yeah. So, yeah, Josh Alexander, I love that match. I liked a lot of the Oku match. I just, you know, it's not my... I'm fed up of matches going 47 minutes just to show they can go 47 minutes. They could have done that story in the length of time of the Josh Alexander match, because that was similarly about someone fighting against adversity and all that stuff. And if you're going to go so scumbag underhand Will Ospreay, then don't have them shake hands at the end of it as like, oh, I'm sorry I hit your girlfriend multiple times. And, you know, trying to do all the callbacks and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, I get it. But...
Look, he loves RevPro and he does love British wrestling, so he does care. And he could maybe spin it of, look what I had to put you through to make sure you were the guy. And what I love is left in a good stead.
The best match for just the moves is the Konosuke Takeshita match. And that's the match we've talked about the least, I suppose. Takeshita, I'll just say he's got a great ass! That was my main observation. And again, I do worry that Konosuke Takeshita will get lost in the shuffle because, as we were saying in the Kenny Omega match, because again, he's been the supporting player in someone else's story. And I don't know that he'll ever have that bond with the crowd. I kind of wish that Takeshita had ended up in New Japan for the last 5 years and had been the Okada to Okada's Tanahashi. I feel like that's a great lost storyline we never got in many ways, because Takeshita was just the DDT guy and never went to... Because he's got that bulk and that size. Look, he's got everything. I just think he's not going to be Ospreay, he's not going to be Okada. And so I need someone to put over Ospreay and Okada. Well, that will be Takeshita. And that'll be the same with Hobbs and to an extent Fletcher, but Fletcher's got more time and more of an underside for him. And I do like the fact that there's this faction in AEW, in the Don Callis family, that look like that's the size of a WWE faction. They wouldn't look out of place in the WWE ring. Very often with AEW, it is like he's 5'10". Well, he's 5'8", so it doesn't look so bad. But these are all guys, as Callis himself said, are all of guys of height, and this idea that he's got like the A-plus stable out there.
The Undisputed Kingdom, bless them, they do need Wardlow to, like, impose will, don't they?
That is true. Yeah, they can't really do that face off because it will be very bad.
What they're left with is Roddy Strong, fair enough, yeah, a man in a wheelchair, and God love him, the kingdom.
Thing is, this could happen now this year. I really want to see if they can make it happen, maybe in Ring of Honor, if just for one match, a Generation Next reunion. Because they have Roderick Strong, Alex Shelley's about to be free, and Austin Aries will never be signed up full-time from anyone who's got a sense anymore. And who the fuck... I don't know if Jack Evans knows where he's going to be next week.
Mm.
So they could do it at least once, but that does remind me of a visual once where they were, when they came out for a Ring of Honor show and they got Baron von Reschke out to like do a bit because he was like a local legend. And they were like, we're going to beat you up. And the problem was that Baron von Reschke was like 6 foot, whatever. And all of Generation Next were like 5'9" max. And so Reschke just said, who is it then? Eeny, meeny, miny, or mo?
Yeah.
So I feel like that will happen if we get...
Hello, can you see me down there?
Yeah. Yeah, I will go... I think across the board, they're all like 4.25 to 4.5 star matches.
Yeah.
The one that I would definitely go 4.5 with is Ospreay, Alexander, and maybe Takeshita. Mm. Kyle Fletcher, like I said, the whole thing is just meant to be... It's kind of like Donovan Dijak and Keith Lee. He's not wrestling the style that he should be wrestling for his size. But as long as you got Ospreay there to do it against, it will work. Kyle Fletcher, it's still a work in progress, but he shows every Raw potential. He just needs to find that package. I like the blonde haircut, actually, more than his previous look. I don't know why he was wearing some tights from The Ascension, though.
Protostar, I think it's his Ring of Honor gimmick.
Yeah.
Because I looked to see what they read, and they read Protostar, and he's never been referred to that on AEW main television, so it must be a Ring of Honor TV title thing.
Mm. Anyway, I think we could have kept going on, but we should employ our own time limit, and we're going to now.
Yeah.
Would you go on the star ratings? Are there any you go beyond like the 4.25, 4.5, either below or above?
No.
But you would say your favourite was...
I would say my favourite, it's the generational thing, like Michaels over Brett, maybe divide that we have. Oku/Takeshita, I would probably say, has joint favourites.
Okay. Yeah, we should have talked more about the Takeshita because the crowd was going apeshit. But again, it was just like Daryl Strawberry hit a home run. That was essentially what it was. You can have this match, you can have this match, let's have that match.
Well, hopefully Takeshita won't be asked to shave his sideburns anytime soon.
Josh Alexander, still like him better than Anthem. But anyway, Simon, if people want to get in touch with you with some more Will Ospreay matches for the future that we can maybe preemptively record our assumptions of what the matches will be, how can they do so?
You can get in touch with me on Twitter, where I'm selling this Simon Cross free. Free for the number of matches I'm hoping in some way get 5 stars from WWE, because we're about to hit our WrestleMania period and I would like to have some variety in our next block.
My name's Lorcan Mullen. That's LorcanMullan for the antiseptic I hope they used with all that blood in the Oku match. There was some...
Well, again, very quickly, that is one of the things I text Lorcan. I'm like, Jesus Christ, I hope Oku got tested.
Yeah, and the other thing I was bothered about was whether Ameri should have been walking around with that belt. Technically, that wasn't Oku's for the course of that match. That belt is absurdly large. Doesn't help making Oku look small as well. But anyway, that's my Twitter handle, Instagram, Facebook, Letterboxd. If you put it on gmail.com at the end of it, that's my email address. Get in touch with the show at lmtyspod@gmail.com. lmtyspod is also our Twitter and Facebook handles. We have, I don't know if this is a special surprise, but we're going to take a little break for a few weeks, but you're not going to get nothing from us. You are going to get, for at least the next 4 weeks, some special compilations that we have put together of previous Meltzer 5-star episodes, so you don't have to go all the way back in the archives to get them downloaded. We're going to give you some best-ofs that are collections of matches that we've covered for the Meltzer 5-star project in the past, maybe edited down a bit. No point of me closing curtains and expecting you to wait for that to be done, if that's in one of them. But the first theme that we'll be talking about is the matches that got us to where we are with the Meltzer 5-star project in the first place, I think. It's the Kazuchika Okada Kenny Omega Tetralogy. That's what it is. I looked it up. And you'll get to hear all 4 of those episodes, one after the other. And then there'll be some more that we'll explain as the series goes on. But there's nothing left to say at this point, except that my name's Lorcan Mullen.
My name's Simon Cross.
Thank you for letting us tell you something. Have a range of somewhere between a 5 to 6 star time. Until the next time.
stop my rocket. There's just